The first comment is that one of you asked me yesterday over lunch about something which I thought was worth mentioning to the rest of you. So you'll notice that with the first postulate, we introduced preparations. And with the second postulate, we introduced measurements. And the third postulate, we introduced dynamics. Now, in the second and third postulates, we introduced ideal measurements, kind of optimal measurements, and optimal transformations. But with the first postulate, we introduced not just kind of optimal preparations, which are rank one projectors or pure states, but we also defined the whole class of mixed preparations in one kind of fell swoop. And so one of the students asked me if that was somehow less fundamental to introduce mixtures axiomatically as I did. And so I guess our first answer to that question is the fact that, in fact, I think it was you that asked me this question about why I have density operators in the postulate. Yeah. So, well, first of all, there's kind of a historical precedent there to introduce density operators as general preparations. And second of all three cases where you learn about the non-ideal scenario or the non-optimal scenario, preparations are by far the most important, and in terms of how they arise in practical circumstance. And thirdly, I'll say that there's an interesting kind of divergence amongst quantum foundations scientists. There's a kind of a growing tendency to think about quantum mechanics. If you write down axioms for quantum mechanics, to write down axioms for the most general allowed transformations and preparations and measurements. I guess the point is this: one has an operational paradigm and the idea is we kind of imagine that this is how quantum mechanics works. So this is a very like simplified cartoon picture of all quantum experiments. So the idea is you have some device and it has a button on it, and that's the start button. And this device has some dials on it, so you can choose different settings. And then one has another box lined up. So this is the output. And then one has another box, which also has some dials on it. So let's make it one dial. And this has an input port and an output port. And then a final box, which has a light which can flash. And it has a gauge on it with a needle that indicates an outcome. And you also have dials on this as well. Okay, so whether I put one dial or two dials is completely immaterial, so please excuse that inconsistency. Here, I'll put a second dial here there. Now they all have two dials. But the point is these are arbitrary dials. The idea is we can choose settings, which may be continuous settings. And the idea is you press the start button with this particular configuration of settings, and the light goes off when an event was detected. The light is actually redundant with just the fact that if the needle has some rest position, some null position, then, you know, when the light goes off, the needle will move and indicate some outcome. Outcome K here, this is outcome K right here. So you can either have a light tell you when to look at the needle, or if you just have the needle point to some ready state, like this first notch could be the ready state, And when the needle leaves the ready state, it means that a detection event occurred. So the idea is that one can prepare the system. One can transform the system. And one can measure the system. So you can ask the question, given access to arbitrary amounts of technology, and assuming quantum mechanics is fundamentally correct, what is the most general description of what can come out of this port? And that would be a density operator. And you can ask, what's the most general general representation of what's happening in this transformation box? So what you've seen from postulate 3 is unitary transformations. Given access to arbitrary technology, that is not the most general transformation allowed by quantum mechanics. It's a special case of a unitary operation is one which will preserve the purity of the state. Okay, so what do we mean by purity? Well, you know, if the state is pure, so if rho is equal to a projector under some state psi, then clearly U acting on rho, so rho at some time later time t, is just U acting on psi and U dagger acting on the dual vector, which we know that U will take psi to some other vector phi, and U dagger will take psi to the dual of phi, and we see that we have a pure state. But more generally, we can characterize the degree of purity of the state. So the degree of purity is given by trace rho squared, which is less than or equal to 1, and greater than or equal to 1 over d, where rho here is a linear operator acting on a d-dimensional Hilbert space. So what that means is you have a d-level system, and the lower bound for this function trace rho squared is 1 over d. And the upper bound is 1. And so we know that if trace rho squared is equal to 1, then the state is pure. That means there exists some vector for which rho can be expressed as a projector onto that vector. Does anyone know which state rho gives the lower bound? The identity state, right. So if rho is pure, which you've already seen this yesterday, if rho is pure, or 2 days ago, then trace rho squared is equal to 1. And if rho is completely mixed, which basically means you know nothing about the preparation, that's the kind of operational sense of it being completely mixed, then trace of identity over d all squared is equal to 1 over d, which you can easily verify. Recall that the trace of the identity without this 1 over d normalization, the trace of the identity is d. So you get a factor of d from summing over the ones in the identity matrix. So the most general transformation, the most general preparation is some density operator which has some degree of purity. Unitaries preserve the degree of purity. So if the input state rho has trace rho squared equal to some real number between 1 and 1 over d, that number will be conserved. So you can just check that by putting UU dagger inside this expression on each side of rho, and you'll easily see using the cyclic property of the trace and the fact that UU dagger is equal to identity, that trace rho squared is conserved under the unitary evolution. So you should probably check that. But the point I'm getting to here is that the unitaries are a special case of the most general transformation you can do using the laws of quantum mechanics. And the more general class is called the class of completely positive maps. Time permitting, at the end of these lectures, I will describe how those maps arise and give you some, describe them to you. But for now, I just want you to know there's a more general class of measurements, which for its transformations, which I did not include in your axiom. And lastly, when it comes to the measurement, the idea here of this notation k is, recall you have some observable a, we can always write A in terms of its spectral decomposition. Now, how would you describe the situation if at least one of these PKs was not a rank one projector? What does that tell you about this observable? This is something you should probably all know, but you might not recognize it in this context. Degeneracy, thank you. So recall I assume you've all heard of degeneracy because that comes up in most introductory quantum mechanical courses. It's the idea that if you write down the matrix representation of A and you diagonalize it, that there's a repetition of the same eigenvalue two or more times. You get the same scalar value of the eigenvalue. So in the context of our spectral decomposition, what that means is that, let's suppose that we have lambda 2 is equal to lambda 3, but lambda k is not equal to lambda k prime for any other values of k. K prime. So that means we have one degenerate eigenvalue in this setup. And what that means for the spectral decomposition is that A is equal to lambda 1 times some rank 1 projector P1. And because it's rank 1, I can just write down some state phi 1, phi 1. And then I'm going to have lambda 2 times a sum over L equals 1 to 2 phi L. Let me do this, 2 to 3 phi L. And then we'll have lambda 4 times phi 4 phi 4 and so on up to lambda D phi D phi D. Sorry, this is a digression, by the way, from the main point I'm making. Just to remind you, because I probably should have mentioned this a couple lectures ago, so let me tell you now. So here, in the case of degeneracy, one has this object here. So each of these are actually projectors. So if I take a projector P2 equal to phi 2, and a projector P3 equal to phi 3, then we can write down a projector, let's call it P2 comma 3, which is equal to phi 2 phi 2 plus phi 3 phi 3. Now, because this is a two-dimensional subspace, you actually have a freedom in what you choose as your eigenvectors as the basis for that subspace. So this is a non-unique choice. In fact, you can take any orthogonal pair of linear combinations of phi 2 and phi 3 to define these projectors. If anyone wants me to clarify what that means, please let me know. Which brings me to a correction. I misspoke last class when I told you about the ambiguity of mixtures, which meant that a mixed state, so a density operator that's not pure, There's an infinite number of decompositions as a sum over projectors. I think I may have said that they would always be orthogonal pairs, and that's not true. In fact, I think only one such decomposition can be an orthogonal pair. I think this came up, one of the students told me this came up in the tutorial, so that's correct. If you write the non-uniqueness is over sets of non-orthogonal projectors onto non-orthogonal vectors. So please bear that in mind. Okay, so here I'm imagining some observable, and the point is the unique, here I'm summing over, by writing it this way, I'm allowing k doesn't necessarily run from 1 to d. In other words, in this setup here, one can just write a is equal to a sum over, let me call it j equals 1 to d minus 1, lambda j, pj. And then it's understood that the lambda 2 eigenvalue has a rank 2 projector associated with it. So when we think about this measurement, so if I choose the dial settings that give me this measurement, I'm going to have d minus 1 distinct outcomes on my indicator, on my needle, or what's it called? The pointer, and to use Schrodinger's terminology. And so each time I press the button, I get a single outcome k, and I can record that in my lab notebook, press the button again. With the same exact dial settings, the light goes off, I get a different outcome. This is the indeterminacy of quantum mechanics. I keep track of how many times each distinct outcome k occurs. The frequency of that outcome should be predicted by the Born rule, which is the probability of that outcome. So here k labels the eigenvalues. Notice that I mentioned earlier to you that think about the eigenvalues as labels rather than physical quantities. When you look at this setup, you realize that the numerical value of this scale is essentially irrelevant. I'm just interested in the distinct outcomes and their labels, which are the k values. And so the numerical value of lambda is immaterial, really, in terms of the operational setup. It's only if I want to estimate some physical quantity, if I believe that this dial setting tells me I'm measuring the x component of angular momentum, then I want these lambdas to have units of angular momentum. But the distinct outcomes is really all I care about from an operational point of view. So to complete my story here about the most general transformations, the most general measurement you can perform using the laws of quantum mechanics is not an observable of this form. So an observable of this form is characterized by the kind of the important or primitive or the fundamental, characterization of the measurement A is the set of distinct projectors. In the spectral decomposition of A. So namely, this set of PKs, where here the index K doesn't necessarily run from 1 to D, because some of those PKs may project onto higher rank subspaces because of degeneracy. So this quantity, the quantity which is kind of operationally relevant, which is this set of projectors, it's this quantity that's picked out by the dial settings. And again, I'll repeat this for probably hopefully the last time. The lambdas are in some sense irrelevant. I just have this set of projectors. And there's a special name for it in quantum mechanics. It's called a PVM, which is what everybody calls it. But what that means is projector valued measure. Which is a very, very heavy-handed description in the context of discrete outcomes. The reason the word measure is in there is not because it's a measurement. The word measure in there is measure in the sense of probability measure. And it has to do with the fact that if the index k is a continuous index, then you need some more sophisticated mathematics to describe what's going on, which we'll touch upon when we look at infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Well, that's what I'm getting to now. So the point is, I just said that this is not the most general measurement. So this PVM measurement is not the most general measurement you can perform in the lab. The most general measurement you can perform according to the laws of quantum mechanics is described not by a PVM, but by a POVM. Which stands for positive operator valued measure. I think I'm inserting superfluous hyphens here. Positive operator valued, actually maybe there should be a hyphen there. I don't know if any of you are English grammar experts. So a PVM is a special case of a POVM. And again, I won't get into this now, but hopefully by the end of the lectures you'll be able to see this. At the very least, you'll see this in some of your exploration courses. POVMs come up a lot in quantum information and quantum foundations. The terminology is heavy-handed, again, because of this context of the possibility of a continuous index of outcomes, which we'll look at later. So axiomatically, the way I've introduced the axioms to you is I said the first axiom is that one has, I described the full set of preparations. So I've hidden nothing from you. But in axioms 2 and 3, where I introduce measurements and transformations respectively, I've given you just the idealized cases, the unitary transformations and the PVM, which is some, every Hermitian operator can be decomposed in a spectral decomposition. So with every Hermitian operator, there is associated some set of projectors, some PVM. But the most general such operations here are great, are supersets of those objects. So there's reasons for introducing the axioms the way I did. I was alluding to the fact that in the quantum foundations community, some people feel it's more appropriate to axiomatize quantum mechanics in terms of these general operations. So they want to state the axioms of quantum mechanics in terms of density operators, completely positive maps, and POVM measurements. Another approach is just to axiomatize quantum mechanics in terms of pure states, unitary transformations, and PVM measurements. And I did kind of a hybrid situation. And the beautiful thing about this is that they're equivalent in a way which I will make clear to you once we introduce tensor product Hilbert spaces. The point, I'll just say it to you in words. If you don't understand this, that's okay. I'll cover it in detail in a few lectures. The point is that any POVM measurement can be realized as a projector valued measurement on a larger composite system. So you introduce an auxiliary quantum system, so you have your system of interest, you connect it with an auxiliary system, you perform a PVM on that combined system, and the effective description of that at the level of the original system is a POVM. So, and similarly for unitary operators and CP maps. So they're essentially equivalent notions if you're allowed to append additional auxiliary quantum systems. Okay, so I'm Just wanted to clarify those concepts. And where are my notes? Over here. So are there any questions? Yeah.
Pointer.
Yeah, I'd say as long as your index is a real number, that's the important thing. There's no meaningful context in which lambda is not a real number, like where it's a complex number or something. I mean, that never happens. But if you wanted to use complex numbers to label the outcomes, you could. It would just be redundant. Yes.
I was told that one reason why we should think it reasonable to insist that the operators that represent measurements or observables must be Hermitian is because of the correspondence between the eigenvalues and outcomes of measurements, and the physically meaningful values have to be real, so the eigenvalue should be real, so the operators should be Hermitian. But if we're saying that it's not the eigenvalues that really matter, it's just the indices, then why bother insisting that operators that observables are represented by Hermitian operators?
That argument sounds a bit backwards to me, in the sense that one's deducing that one has to have Hermitian operators for measurements from the fact that you want these labels to be real. And I think that's not the way it goes. I think the way it goes is you find out what is the representation of your measurements. It's Hermitian operators, and then it follows that those labels will be real. I wouldn't infer the nature of the operators from...
It was just presented to me as a reason to think it reasonable that we should insist that the operators are Hermitian. Then how would you find out that the operators must be Hermitian? Did you say that you find out that the operators must be Hermitian, and then did you say...
This is my escape hatch to your question. So the remember at the beginning of class, I actually explicitly addressed the fact that the situation of the axioms of quantum mechanics is unsatisfactory, that they were discovered kind of through some kind of mathematical guesswork. And there was no set of principles which told us what the axiom should be. We just know from empirical confirmation these axioms are correct. And so I think the deepest answer to your question is an open research problem, which is deducing why do we have to represent measurements in the way we do with the operators we do represent them with. So that would be my answer, that we don't know, ultimately. I mean, there are some reconstruction approaches which would give some reason to believe measurements should have that form. In fact, I'll just get you in a moment, Tibra. This is the issue with, I think some people prefer articulating the axioms of quantum mechanics in terms of POBMs and so on, because they can deduce those quantities from some sets of principles. And it's a matter of taste whether you like one person's derivation over another, but there's no consensus on the right way to do it yet. Yeah?
I think there are some people working on what are known as PT, what is known as a p-symmetric quantum mechanics, where they try to actually replace the axiom of Hermiticity by a p-symmetric operator as well. And then they argue that a lot of physics actually follows from just having a p-symmetric operator.
Yeah. That can have non-real eigenvalues.
I think what I'm trying to say is that there are people who are trying to do that. I don't know how successful.
Yeah.
We need Carl Benderbeck.
So anyways, I mean, that's a great question because it's very much a question of current interest. We're trying to understand why do we have to represent quantum mechanics the way we do. There's no answer yet. So I'm going to launch into a discussion of composite systems and entanglement. However, first I'd like to finish up a couple of remarks about postulate 3. So postulate 3 was the unitary evolution. We went over the Schrodinger and the Heisenberg pictures. And recall in the Heisenberg picture, okay, what's different about this equation than the one I gave you in axiom three? Yeah?
The Heisenberg form and the order of the unitary.
Right, so notice that the order of the U and the H are switched here. And why is that? Well, because in the Heisenberg picture, the observables, of which the Hamiltonian function, the energy function, is such an observable, are expressed like this, where the non-subscripted H is in the Schrodinger picture. And so if you substitute, you recover axiom three, as it was stated. And so I believe I gave you this already, but I'll just repeat it here. In the Heisenberg picture, one can write down a differential equation for the time evolution of any observable. And it has the following form. So this term will be zero unless there is an explicit time dependence in the observable and the subscript H here means, of course, we sandwich this between a U dagger and a U. And then in the Schrodinger picture, one gets by differentiation. So here I'm including the S, but we could just drop it as per our convention. So this is called the von Neumann equation. The von Neumann equation is a generalization of the Schrodinger equation to the case where we allow, where we were using density operators to describe our preparation. And so you can easily check that if rho s of t is equal to u of t t naught rho at t zero, U dagger T T naught. Let rho be pure. Then you have basically psi of T is equal to U psi of zero, and you have that psi of t in the dual space is equal to psi of zero adjoint, which you get just from inspection of that equation. And then, of course, from this, by differentiation, differentiation,
you get the Schrodinger equation.
Under the identification, I should have inserted somewhere in here the fact that U is equal to this is for time independent age. This bit isn't in my typed up notes, but just my handwritten notes.
I have a question about this approach.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The first equation that you've written in the Heisenberg picture, that looks suspiciously like the Schrodinger equation if I didn't have the subscript H. Is that also true in the Heisenberg picture? Or because if I start from the Schrodinger equation, mm-hmm. so I didn't have the subscript H, mm-hmm. and I sandwich it between U dagger of U, I should be getting that equation, right, with the subscript H.
Which equation?
The first one. In the Heisenberg picture, one has...
Right, so you're saying you insert this into here?
Right.
Yeah, then you recover the Schrodinger form. Because this H has no subscript. You guys should be giving me a hard time here because I'm going a little fast and loose. Normally I like to proceed more deductively, and I'm being a little bit careless with the I haven't really made the identification. So one has this differential equation, whether it's in the Heisenberg or the Schrodinger picture, and then you want to find a solution to that differential equation. Now, if H is time independent, then the solution has this form. And if H is time dependent, then you have this time-ordered exponential. As the general solution. And then once you've identified this solution, so once you have this solution, that you can deduce this equation. That's the step I skipped in going from that picture, which comes from the axiom, to this picture, which is the familiar setting that you've seen in undergrad. Yeah? You mean the difference in these two?
Yeah.
No, this is the fact that, so if you, here, let's assume that rho is pure, and then you have some pure state here. And then what's the best way to put this? So basically, let me just write this out. So recall that for any Hilbert space, for any Hilbert space H, one has a dual space. Which, by I think Rietz's theorem, is isomorphic to the original space. It's a nice property of Hilbert spaces. So that means that for every psi in H, there exists a vector psi in the dual to H, H adjoint, which is equivalent to the original Hilbert space. And so what we have here is we have U, I'll just drop the argument, the time-dependent argument of psi of 0, psi of 0 U dagger, and that's going to be equal to psi of t, psi of t. So the point is, you can think of this object here as psi of t, and then you can think of this object as psi of t, and you can think of them as kind of independent objects. So the Hilbert space vector is evolving under some operator, u, and the dual space vector is evolving under the adjoint of u. And each one, so this one essentially generates this state, and this one generates that state. And so this piece of it is what I'm writing here, and the other piece is what I'm writing there. So this doesn't have anything to do with the difference between the Schrodinger and the Heisenberg picture. It has to do with the fact that, by the way, the origin of the dual, have you guys, how many of you have not seen a discussion of dual spaces and functionals? Some of you have only seen it a little bit. So let me suggest that, because most of you are familiar with this, let me suggest it as a review for those of you who haven't. The point of the dual space is in part to define the inner product. So when you have the inner product between two vectors, if you have phi and psi, this is equal to some scalar. The idea is you can think of this, the action of phi on psi is essentially some linear functional acting on psi. And it turns out for every linear functional acting on psi, there is an associated vector in the dual space. And this kind of underlies the linear algebraic structure of quantum mechanics. So please review it in the course notes that were put on the wiki. It's gone, I go through it in detail in the mathematical review chapter, which is like chapter 2 or something. So please review that if you're not familiar with it. Yeah?
Are you planning to go through the time order exponential at some point? Or?
I wasn't, but do you think that would be?
Well, if time permits, you know, this is something that we'll see in the field theory.
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Dyson series.
Right. Okay, so I'll see if I can get it in. Yeah. Okay, let me just make sure there's nothing I've skipped here. Okay, good. Yeah.
That H dagger or the dual space is equivalent to the original Hilbert space?
Yeah, it's isomorphic. So it's like a structure preserving bijection between the two spaces. Okay, composite systems and entanglement. So just by a show of hands, how many of you have seen in your previous courses the tensor product structure of quantum mechanics? About half. And how many of you have seen a discussion of entanglement, definition of entangled states, and so on? About half of you. That's pretty good. Okay. Well, I'll go through it somewhat quickly then. Basically, so you consider two systems. We'll label A and B, and they each have associated to them some Hilbert space. HA and HB, respectively. By the way, so when there's a little serif on my H, that's a Hilbert space, and when it's no serif, then it's Hamiltonian. So to be definite, let's let these be finite dimensional systems. So let HA equal an m-dimensional vector space, and HB will be equal to an n-dimensional Hilbert space. And then we can define an orthonormal basis for this Hilbert space. What do I need my notation here? Let's call it AK, where K goes from 1 to M. And this guy, we can just choose some orthonormal basis that we like. And I think this is called BL. And this index runs from 1 to N. Now, every system has a Hilbert space associated with it, so the composite system must have a Hilbert space associated with it. The Hilbert space of the joint system or the composite system, we can use either word. Is equal to the tensor product of these, of the Hilbert spaces of the two systems individually. This means that HAB is spanned by an orthonormal basis where K and L run from M to N, respectively. So then, any state chi that belongs to HAB can be expressed as a linear combination over this basis. So that means we sum over L and K. And we'll have coefficients C, LK. AK, tensor BL. And how do we find the coefficients C, LK? Right, so it's CLK is equal to AK BL acting on chi. So notice that we have a tensor symbol. So this is the dual vector. And there's a tensor product symbol explicitly. And then this one, the tensor product symbol is suppressed because it's just a vector in this Hilbert space. So these are complex numbers as usual. I mean, this whole expression, of course. So how do we write this down? So just to remind you how to do this, because there's a convention involved. Suppose I have some vector. Let phi be some vector in Aj, and psi be some vector in Hb. Then with respect to the orthonormal bases, one has phi is equal to a sum over k, alpha k, ak, where alpha k is equal to the inner product ak with phi. And similarly, one can expand psi in terms of its Hilbert space with beta L defined similarly. And now if we go to a matrix representation, we represent the state as a column vector, and you would have alpha 1, alpha 2, all the way down to alpha m. And this guy would be represented by beta 1, beta 2, all the way down to beta n. And then the joint state, let some state omega equal psi, got that backwards, by tensor psi. Now notice that what people will do sometimes for clarity of notation, although it's slightly redundant, is they'll put an A here and a B here. So this tells you that phi belongs to system A and psi belongs to system B. But what's commonly done is just have the order in which the state is presented to the left or to the right of the inner product. So anything on the tensor, anything on the left of the tensor product is system A, on the right of the tensor product is system B. And then you can suppress those subscripts and people will understand what you're doing. Then the point is the matrix representation of omega is going to be a column vector. How many elements will this column vector have? M times n. And the matrix elements, now we have a choice. So the choice is which index varies most rapidly. So the convention I use is that the right hand, things on the right hand side of the tensor product vary most rapidly. So you would have alpha 1, beta 1, alpha 1, beta 2, all the way down to alpha 1, beta n. And then you'd have alpha 2, beta 1, and so on, all the way down to alpha m, beta n. And then each of these numbers is just a scalar, a complex number. So even though you've seen the tensor, most of you have seen the tensor product in your previous quantum classes, there's two instances where you maybe didn't realize that you're implicitly using the tensor product. When you have a wave function, a state psi, so an example, if you have a state in 2D, so the idea is you have some psi of x and y. So a two-dimensional harmonic oscillator. Really what this means is psi x, well, I'm going to call it psi x, tensor psi y. So if you call this a vector thing. So really this means some tensor structure. So we think about using the tensor product structure, we have two systems. So one spin particle here, another spin particle there. We want to describe both particles at the same time, we use the tensor product. But it's also the right quantity to use when you're talking about a single particle with two spatial degrees of freedom. So an electron is free to move around in a two-dimensional surface, then the wave function associated with its x motion, basically its x motion is a Hilbert space, and its y motion is another Hilbert space. And the joint 2D motion is given by the tensor product of those two Hilbert spaces. Yeah?
So in the free harmonic oscillator, that kind of makes sense. But what if I were to consider the hydrogen atom where the differential equation is separable, but of the different, you know, the polar coordinates, the different. Should I think of the different wave functions in the hydrogen atom as tensor product as well?
That's a good question.
I mean, I can think of the best tensor product, except that not each of them will satisfy some sort of, the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if you use polar coordinates, it's not clear to me that that decomposition is associated with a tensor product of, say, the angular degree of freedom and the. I could try and think it through right now, but it's probably better if I think about that offline, because that sounds like a tricky question. But certainly it's the case with. It might have something to do with, I'm just guessing, but yeah. Certainly in the case of Cartesian coordinates, this is valid. In other coordinate systems, I'm not certain. My guess is that yes, it would be, but I'm just not certain. It would be a tensor product. Because as long as the components are independent quantities, I mean, if you classically, you can think of them as independent variables, then normally, quantumly, you'd think of them as each having their own Hilbert space. So similarly, if we have two matrices, so if I have UA, another example, if I have UA tensor UB acting on my state chi, which I gave earlier, this guy, then the way we evaluate this is to expand chi in terms of a joint basis, AK and BL, and we would evaluate the action of UA and B by taking out my coefficients, C, L, K, and then U, A, which is on the left of the tensor symbol, acts on A, K, and U, B acts on B, L. And then this we can evaluate in the usual way, and thereby calculate the transformation applied jointly. And then the representation of UA tensor UB in terms of a basis, a matrix representation, if UA is represented by a matrix with elements, let me do it this way. Let me call it UA 1, 1, UA 1, 2. UA1M, UAM, 1, and UAMM. So UA is represented by an M by M matrix. Similarly, UB is represented by a N by N matrix. Then the joint, sorry, this is the side down there. Then the joint system would be represented by, you also have to respect the same ordering convention. So you would, what that means is the right-hand matrix gets embedded next to each of these coefficients. So you would have UAB would be represented by a matrix where the first matrix element would be UA11, regular, this is a scalar, this is a complex number. So we just multiply two complex numbers. And the first matrix element is UA11, UB11. The second matrix element is UA11, UB, row, column, 1, 2. So you can think of this as the representation of UA tensor UB is UA11 times the full matrix associated with UB, and then UA12 times the full matrix, well, not times, but you create a submatrix where each element of UB is multiplied by UA11, and then a submatrix where each element of UB is multiplied by U12, and so on. And so then you would go down to here. And then down here, you would have U21A times UB11, and so on. Is the pattern, well, for those of you who can actually see this, is the pattern clear enough? Anyways, it's also in those notes, so you can just check. I go through it in detail in the notes. And then there's various properties that, like linearity and so on, the tensor product satisfies, which you should read through. Now, entanglement.
Question?
Yeah.
So the last example assumes that the Hamiltonian doesn't have a term which consists of two.
Hold on one second. Yes?
The last example assumes that the Hamiltonian of the system doesn't have a term which consists of two systems, right?
Yeah, so this is two independent actions. So this is not the most general transformation. This is a simple transformation, and that's its representation. More general transformations won't have this tensor product form. For example, if I give you this state chi, which you can't see now, this will become clear if I just keep going and then. So what I showed you previously was that any chi in the composite Hilbert space admits a decomposition in terms of this is called a product basis. Our tensor product basis. So one has an orthonormal basis of the joint Hilbert space in terms of tensor products of the bases of the individual Hilbert spaces. Now there exist orthonormal bases of the joint Hilbert space which don't have this form. So for those of you who are familiar with combining two spin half particles, when you switch basically from the individual spin half up and down basis to the singlet and the triplet basis, you're going from a product basis to a entangled basis, basically. Yeah?
Sorry, can you just write a little bit bigger?
Oh, sure.
It's really hard for
me to think. Okay, yeah, no problem. All right. So this is actually what I had written down previously.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So in special cases, and what I mean by that is there exist states I'm not writing bigger, sorry. There exist states in HAB which have the form let's call it W where W could be written as, say, phi, running out of state, we call it xi tensor eta, say. So this is a state in the Hilbert space, which is just, essentially, compare these two states, this has just one term in the sum. So this kind of state is called a product state. Sorry, that's product state. And it's a special case. More generally, when a state's in this form. The point is that if there does not exist a choice of basis such that one can find a single term in this expression, such that one has a decomposition with a single term, then the state is entangled. Let me just write that down. A pure state chi in HAB that can be expressed as chi is equal to alpha tensor beta for some pair, for some alpha which lives in HA and beta which lives in HB, is called a product state or a factorable state or an unentangled state. Otherwise, the state is called entangled. So I think it's probably best to turn to a discussion of the operational significance of entangled states in the following lecture. Before we wrap up, are there any questions?
You're right. So is there an easy way of seeing what, given a state that it's entangled?
Yeah.
Without checking?
Yeah, so it turns out that if the state of the joint system is a pure state, which I've notationally demanded here, then there exists a procedure for determining if the state is entangled or not using the partial trace, which we'll discuss in the next lecture. If the state operator associated with the joint system is a mixed state, so if it's not pure, then it's an open research problem to determine if that state is entangled. In special cases, like two-level systems or a two-level system and a three-level system, there exists a test. But for the generic case of arbitrary dimensional Hilbert space, it's an open research problem and a very fundamental problem. So if you solved it, that would be a really good thing. Presumably there is some solution, but no one's figured it out. Yeah?
You can set that on the first rule.
Yeah, first homework. There you go. All right, good. All right, well, anyways, we'll discuss those issues next lecture. Thanks again for your attention.